Hello, and welcome to recording number 19 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated recording. I'm going to restart here on page 135, paragraph 3. Gord moved to position himself where he could make effective use of the dagger. No sense in pitting himself face to face with the soldier's longer arms. From behind or in a grappling melee, the blade would be deadly, but against longsword or great axe, the disadvantage would be telling. Only one of the men-at-arms was still horsed. Another fought beside his slain steed, broad-bladed sword swinging in vicious arcs. At least two of the crossbowmen had dropped their missile weapons to join their embattled fellows in the glen. Bogadar, armed with a huge morning star, stepped before their advance, and with a mighty swing wounded one, despite his mail, before either could react. Then both soldiers countered with swords, and the half-orc was hotly defending himself from their cuts and thrusts as Gord crept closer to the action. Bogadar might have been strong, but he wasn't skilled at arms. In a minute he was bleeding, and in another he was down. The soldiers were good, but that didn't prevent Gord from striking as soon as he got his blade within range of one soldier's back. The supernaturally keen point of his dagger passed through the steel mesh of the foeman's mail coat as if it were mere leather, and a second blow finished the job. The dead man's comrade had been heading off to assist the unhorsed soldier, who was now hard-pressed defending himself against several of the bandits. The sound of his partner's demise made him turn back quickly, however. When he saw Gord taking the dead soldier's sword, he raised his own brand and rushed to revenge his fallen mate. Gord barely had time to raise the newly gained sword and ward off the man's opening stroke. Gord found himself in a lengthy fencing match that tested his skills and abilities to their fullest. The soldier was better than he at swordplay, but Gord had the advantage of his dagger to ward and threaten. Both opponents were bleeding from small cuts, Gord more so than the armored foeman, but Gord was fast and agile, and far fresher than the mail-burdened swordsman opposing him. The soldier aimed a flurry of blows at Gord, and when this onslaught forced Gord to retreat, the fellow finally took the opportunity to unsheath his own poniard. Now the soldier thought the match to be balanced, or unbalanced rather, in his favor, and he moved in for the kill. Gord hurled his dagger with full force into his opponent's thigh. The soldier, in severe pain, made an off-balance lunge that Gord easily dodged, then prepared to attack again. But the fellow couldn't keep from glancing down for a fraction of a second at the hilt of the weapon protruding from his thigh. That blink of time was all Gord needed. He struck a desperate blow with his sword, using both hands to maximize its effect. Blade edge snapped steel links and bone as it clove the shoulder, sending the soldier to the ground, never to rise again. Another one down, thought Gord, as he crouched and rapidly surveyed the area nearby for other antagonists. There was no one to be seen, only still forms. From the trees around the hollow, he heard the sounds of battle, a shout, a cry, and then only silence broken by weak groans from the bodies scattered nearby. Gord stepped into the darkness and waited. A few minutes passed, and then he heard the sound of cautious footsteps approaching the encampment in the hollow. The twin fires burned but feebly now, and it was difficult to distinguish anything beyond a few paces from them. A dark shape entered the clearing, moving from body to body. Gord wished he had his dagger, but he hefted the big sword, preparing to face another opponent. The unidentified man came closer. Then a tongue of flame from a burning log shot up for a moment and brought more brightness to the place. The grim face of Finn was revealed in the brief glow. "Hey, Finn," called Gord softly, using the fellow's name to give immediate assurance of friendliness. "I'm here. Who else lives?" With that, Gord moved slowly from his place of concealment and allowed Finn a moment to identify him before he went to the body of the dead soldier and recovered his precious dagger. Finn watched him with a stony expression. "So our captive is now one of the surviving company of Freetakers," he said with sarcasm in his voice. "Well, shit. You must be pretty good or you wouldn't have made it, I suppose. Most of these others sure didn't." He left it at that and returned to his inspection. Gord noted with a shudder that he was slitting throats. As it turned out, Finn determined that only three of his comrades had less than mortal wounds. They would recover and be well enough to move on in a couple of days. Finn and Gord had checked every fallen person, soldier and bandit alike. Hopelessly wounded comrades and foemen were emotionlessly done in by the tall brigand. The dead were stripped of any valuables, and the horses of the men-at-arms were tethered with the draft animals of the bandits. Gord's heart lifted at the sight of his own stallion securely tied with the latter. Break. Well, that's an extended bit of action right there. We get You get an idea here where Gord mentions, and in this fight, he isn't as skilled as the soldier who's following him, and that these soldiers from the Cannon of Redmaud, from the Pale, they are obviously better than the bandit-level fighters. The other thing that we have that I think was interesting was that they're slaying the grievously injured, which was considered, it used to be called the mercy stroke. And that's something that's kind of glossed over in most games, is that if you don't have access to, magical healing, most of these people could expect to die from serious wounds, and if not, even for minor wounds that might get infected. Now, it's not something that it's something that's hand waved in most of most gaming, but it is something to think about. The group here is Finn names them the Company of Freetakers. So we have this little bandit gang that is, like almost like the mercenary group. They're actually named themselves, but they don't seem to have been all that numerous, unless there's more of the gang somewhere else. All right.
It did seem like they held up pretty good against those mounted riders.
Yeah, the first group, but then you have Bogador there being brought down fairly easily, and the thing with him is that he was seemed to be more of a wrestler. He did very well against Gordon hand to hand, where he wasn't that skilled with his, his weapon, and that's what Gord says is he wasn't. I also note that Gord reverts back to using his broadsword like a cleaver, a cleaving weapon rather than a jabbing weapon. Mm-hmm. Now, he's fighting a man in mail, and, that would be harder. The mail would protect from, the probably the kind of damage a broadsword would be able to do. You'd think the dagger, it seems odd to me that he threw the dagger, but, you know, since that can go right through mail, it seemed like it would be more, you know, useful and a surprise against the soldier. But, you know, there I did like the fact that we had that Gord, you know, he switches to the broadsword in two hands and really uses it as a cleaving, smashing weapon. And, you know, at you know, medieval fighting was mostly... they didn't stab a lot, you know, they mainly, you know, a lot of these weapons like broadswords and such, they did not have a good, point, a good thrusting point. And a lot of it was using them, you know, like a cleaver. The old Saxons, they were named after the weapon, the sax, which was kind of like a sword that curved off to almost like an axe head to it, you know, so... you know, it is interesting. I don't think I've ever really seen the sax as a weapon in gaming, because it, you know, it was a bit of an odd weapon. No, this was action, and we do get some description of the combat and what you can do to talk about how the combat's going. And it wasn't, you know, was not a, it was a, I thought it was a pretty interesting little fight right here, but we don't really learn much except a little about Gord's skill. We learned the name of the bandits, the company of free takers, but it's just more, and then about how they react, which I think is really half, you have to decide how much detail or how much grimness you want to add to the campaign. But if you are dealing with it, then you would have to take into account that severely wounded, like people reduced to a zero, or, you know, they're going to die, or if they have any grievous wounds. And with low-level characters, it's very easy to reduce them to zero and negative hit points. So
they're, without clerical aid or healing potions, they're done.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always gamed where you could bandage wounds and stabilize them, and, you know, like gain a hit point that would bring somebody from zero to one.
I think barbarians have a bind.
Yeah, and I you know, I would think that you should have clerics be able to do that, to bind wounds, I you know, if they're healing clerics. And I, you know, I think that's worth differentiating and having it as something mentioned in the character background, or if you're using a skill system to have some kind of bind wounds. But here we obviously have a Finn. Going to restart 137, and it is paragraph 5. Seeing as how there's none to object just flatly, you and I get to divvy up the spoils. I'll take 5 shares for my work, for Jan, Crowbait, and Colonus. All right, had a little technical difficulty there, and so I'm restarting. We had finished up on taking a break at page 138, paragraph 5. And before we restart, just to cover some of the things that may not have been recorded when we had the bit of technical difficulty. What we were discussing, besides some points about, you know, the scenario that was happening right here, was one that I thought was very important, was that the listing here of the goods and the material that we hear, that the bandits raid into Pale. And instead of just being a listing of coin or, you know, here they're actually showing that loot and treasure does not necessarily have to be gems and coin. They're saying that there's bales of good, rare commodities, fur pelts and ivory from the north, brocaded cloth and tapestries from Tenai artisans, and devotional incense from the Pale, intended for the markets of Relmord and Nyrond. So that gives us some information right there. You know, here the Tenites are they're making tapestry, brocaded cloth, so that for sale. So those are rare commodities, but here we have an idea then in our campaign setting that we can look at those as resources and the skills. If you're going to have a city or a town in Ten, the Duchy of Ten, then you can, you know, here it is an idea of what you can see would be the crafts and the shops and the things that might be there, and adventure ideas about trade goods. Maybe, like, here we have bandits stealing these trade goods. And then what it takes, I'm not sure offhand, to create the devotional incense in the Pale. So that's another bit of information there on what kind of things you could see and encounter in a Palish town. So I find that very, very interesting. I mentioned that we also have the names and ideas behind this company of bandits, the company of free takers. So I think it'd be very worthwhile to detail them as a bandit gang and detail the NPCs. We have Trigon, the leader, and Finn. We have several surviving, just three surviving ones, and we have Bogadar. So, you know, that I thought was, you know, that was something I'd like to do myself, is sit down and detail them out. And that's, I find that one of the nice things about reading through Gygax's books is I find so much that's inspirational. Now, if we go back to thinking about Ten, here's a question been brought up, or just in general, that in Ten we would see weaving and needlework, sheep raising for wool or a plant fiber. Now, the one thing about raising sheep is it would require a very settled area. Ten would have to be very settled to have areas where there would be sheep. Because most of the time, it'd be very hard to protect sheep herds from raiding monsters and predators and intelligent creatures. You know, and so, how would you keep the sheep alive? And that is, so, you know, you could see where, like, say, a horde of cattle, they might be, you know, they might be able to be kept alive easier than a herd of sheep. Sheep are particularly vulnerable. You know, they have, you know, they have the rams and stuff, but you would need more than just like a shepherd and a crook and a you know, a dog or two to keep them in line. You'd need something to protect them. So that speaks, if we're going to look at sheep in an area, and I know that seems minor, but if you're going to look at sheep in an area in a campaign, then it would mean that that area has to be safe. It has to have driven out the monsters, the big predators, and the raiding humanoids. And, you know, that's why even the smallest thing has connotations. All right, I am going to restart. And we are on page 138, and it is paragraph 6. Finn wanted the gold reliquary more than any of the other treasure. Ford agreed he could have it for a quitclaim on everything else, provided that he could get the agreement of Jan, Crowbait, and Kalanis, that 7 shares went to Gord, and 1 to each of them. "They'll agree," said Finn with a sly smile, "because they know that they're not in good enough shape to argue with me." Finn accompanied Gord and the wounded outlaws only as far as the edge of Netherwood. He rode toward Midmeadow. Then, while Ford and the others made for Longford. As they passed through the shallows, crossing their Atonsomay into the bandit kingdoms, Gord wondered what fate would befall the lone man. Finn had indeed gained a far better monetary exchange, for the reliquary and its contents easily outvalued the whole of the other treasure by a factor of not less than 6 to 1. But that disparity didn't trouble Gord in the least. Somehow, he thought, those Palish soldiers had managed to follow him wherever he went, despite tricks that should have at least thrown them off his trail for a bit. Somehow they had located him in the bandit camp, even though they couldn't have tracked him through that marsh at night. Luck, perhaps. The noise of the rowdy outlaws during his testing had been over loud, but nevertheless, Gord did not believe that Finn would lead a long and prosperous life from the proceeds of sale of the temple's prize. That evening, Gord and his bandit companions arrived at their destination, the outlaw city of Stoink, where they could dispose of the goods and horses and rest without fear of pursuit. At last, Gord was coming to a place where everyone he met was a thief of one sort or another, and he relished the prospect. Not that he expected things would be much different, but perhaps hypocrisy and pretense would be done away with. Imagined, he thought, a place where officials honestly admit their robbery. Break. All right. So we're given some bits on the location, but the thing that strikes me the most is we had been talking previously about how they were tracking Gord, and that the reliquary might not only be a symbol and a valuable piece of gold, but it was also something that might have some kind of magic on it, or at least the cannon might be able to track it with some kind of magical device or divination. So it does sound like there's some kind of magic that the soldiers had in possession, and they knew where the reliquary was going. That was something I'm always interested to see that Gygax, he is thinking about what is happening in this story. Like another comment that I'd thought is how those soldiers on horses were able to, you know, kind of surprise the brigands, even with them watching the fight. Now, I would think that even with the fight, they would have assigned guards, you know, outer perimeter guards. Like, they didn't know anybody was coming, and yet they had the guards, the sentries that caught Gord. You would think that somebody would still be watching when the others were distracted by the fight. But still, Gygax is kind of answering this, saying that the rowdy outlaws were over loud. Now, we're given a little detail on the Netherwood and them riding off toward Mid-Meadow and Longford, which, you know, here's another Ford town. They're talking about the Atonsomay and pass through the shallows. So that region there, then that gives you an idea then that you could not, if the Atonsomay is shallow and fordable at that point, then you're not going to have barges and large boats being able to cross from that point either north or south. So something like Mid-Meadow and Longsford, they are going to be important places, because if you are moving goods up and down the Atonsomay and they come to an area where they have to stop and there's a town, then you're going to need, if you're moving things farther north or south, that is going to be the transshipment point. And so that would be where those towns big villages or towns, a good reason for them to be there. And it kind of gives you an idea, what are you going to need there? Well, you're going to need warehouses, and you're going to need places that repair barges and boats. So the littlest thing can really add detail to the campaign. So if you see what's going on here, that little mention is just a small little mention, but it really adds something and a little idea, it's a little detail that you're going to use. And there we have up there, there's Stoink. And Stoink is on one of the bends of the Artansame and in the Bandit Kingdoms. And so we have the first mention of Stoink. And Gord has never been there, but he's giving you an idea of what he thought it would be like. Now, Gord still has this sometimes naivete, and he's relishing the prospect of getting there. He really, he really doesn't know much about it, but he thinks it's a way of disposing. Now, the other thing is now he's got three more companions, because Finn is the one who takes off and leaves his wounded companions in the care of Gord. And I would assume that with Gord's personality and skills that he's going to have a little group there, but we'll see, in the continuing story, what the situation is.
Yeah, also on that map is Longford to the north on the Artansame, and then Midmeadow down to the south. So all three of the points that were just discussed are on the map.
All right. Okay, cool. I mean, because you... Oh, yes, I see it. I didn't realize the positioning that, they were going... Gord was traveling southwest a little to get to Stoink. And you could see there where the Artansame has this long southerly curve and then loops around and goes back north again to get to Stoink. And it's by the way the crow flies, it's a much shorter distance to go from Longsford to Stoink.
Overland,
and there's marked on this map, which, there's two roadways marked, but that is more toward... it depends on what kind of campaign you're following. I mean, the way some of the rivers are and the way that... pardon me. The way that some of the rivers are and road systems and stuff is more of ideas from... second edition stuff, post Gygax, and also maybe some fan creation stuff, or the Living Greyhawk Gazetteer, or the campaign that came afterwards on these maps. So, but there's Longsford, and again at that point, that should be there's the Artansame, and there is a so that is the Shallows. So if you're taking, and you look how far you could come, unless there's other fords, how long that trip would be, traveling up the Artansame to Longsford, and then further north. And so you would definitely have Longsford being, have certain things, if not a city, and it's not marked as one, but an important town. And I cannot spot
Midmarch. That's a city just as big as Stoink.
Midmeadow is a big city. Yeah. Okay.
It's down in the, southeastern corner.
Oh, my.
It's of like four roads.
I see it now. That doesn't make any sense to have Midmeadow down there, I think. Well, maybe not. I don't know. No, you're right. It could be. I was making an assumption.
Who went to Nyrond?
Finn. Finn went to Midmeadow alone,
yep.
And it's Gord who went to Longsford, and then down to Stoink.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess that is the mark, a point where you're crossing into the Bandit Kingdoms.
Yeah, so, it's not that much. I mean, Longsford isn't that far away from the Netherwood. It's just, I don't know, it looks like... I'm not sure what the scale is, but it's a little bit from the up from the Yole.
Yeah, this scale is, I believe, 12 miles a hex. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the inch scale is on it. And what we're talking about here is that we have We have a channel here on the Cannon Fire Discord, and hopefully at some point we're going to have a text forum underneath the archives, the recorded archives on the Cannon Fire website, and there we can add all these maps and details so that, if you're coming to it and listening to it, you can see some of the things that we're commenting about that are visual. You can also write in questions and we could answer them in the forum and such. But, I'll try to make sure to verbalize, what we're seeing here. And since these are available maps, you should be able to pull these up online or even scroll back, drop at the Cannon Fire Discord and scroll back to see by date what we're looking for. And in today's, the archives are, the recordings are listed by date. It is recording number 19, and today is June 28th, 2021. So if you were looking for this map, you could go back and look for the maps that we posted right here on the Greyhawk Fiction channel here on the Cannon Fire Discord.
Well, I'm keeping most of this stuff in OneNote now, so maybe after we're done, I can export it to PDF or something. That might be helpful.
Might be. So we have the whole thing, but
yeah.
I'm hoping that we do have. I don't know how it's going to be set up. I'd like to see a form for every day, but he might just want to do an overall form for all the just the one novel, and then maybe do another forum for the next novel. Because we're up to 19 now, and it looks like we're going to have about at least 45, 50 of these recordings.
Right.
All right, I'm going to restart here. We're on chapter 15, page number 140, the first paragraph. Once the Aridians had amassed an empire that extended far beyond the modern-day boundaries of what is known as the Great Kingdom. At its height, the northern frontier reached all the way to the northern bank of the Artansame River. Stoink was then a military outpost. First a fortified encampment, the place grew rapidly to become a town. As imperial troops were brought there to prepare for further conquest, with them came a host of civilians, craftsmen, sutlers, camp followers, and the lot. When the expansion of the Erdi Empire stopped, the locale became a bastion against invaders. It was walled and became a garrison place. The ebb of the Overking's power came slowly. As the edges of the empire crumbled into sovereign states, Stoink was more and more isolated from its distant rulers, and took on greater individuality and independence. After some four centuries, its inhabitants turned to banditry, and for 200 years thereafter, right down to this day, they have continued to be robbers. The town was now Gord's home, and it felt right to him. Break. All right, that is a very informative bit of text right there. That's one paragraph. And here we get a little bit of history and some detail about Stoink. Here it is like the Romans, where they would have an encampment, and the encampment would become a town, and then a fortification in a town. And when the empire shrinks away, it then becomes in itself a independent town, and part of what became the Bandit Kingdoms. It gives you an idea of why out here there are these various Bandit Kingdoms, and why it's fragmented and wild, the Bandit Kingdoms are not only a place where each is, and they vary the number of them, but the Bandit Kingdoms are also wild land, so that they're a dangerous place. And you have these various kind of almost like city-states. And we're also, just, I like the business hearing about the information about the Erdi Empire, about the Great Kingdom, and then about the time that this all took, because we're given to know that this took place 6 centuries previously, where Stoink breaks away, and then slowly, and then 4 centuries, it slowly turns to banditry, and then 2 centuries of being just a bandit kingdom. And so we can kind of date, what happened in the bandit kingdom and why it became what it did. All right, I am going to restart here. We have a little time left. It is page number 140, paragraph 2. The town proper had perhaps 12,000 people. 2 suburbs, Holdroom and Rat's Wharf, brought the total to 14,000 when there were a few bandit-come-merchant caravans or mercenary companies in the area. Stoink was actually a city-state, for its lord mayor was also boss of a considerable territory, essentially what had once been a frontier march in fiefdom, granted from the overking of Erdi, Boss Daly, lord mayor of Stoink, despotically ruled the destinies of somewhere between 50 and 70,000 folk, provided his enforcers were on hand to back up his dictates. Otherwise, residents and visitors alike did pretty much as they pleased. They made for a wild, brawling, and thoroughly chaotic community, with competing factions constantly at each other's throats. Break. Right, here's a little joke on Gygax's spot, that Stoink is obviously Chicago, with, Boss Daly, who used to be the Chicago... Actually, his son was the recent mayor of Chicago.
Right.
Old Boss Daly was known as a corrupt, a corrupt mayor. All right, now we've got some interesting business here. We've got 12,000 within the town proper, and I'd assumed it's walled. It was a fortification, and it became a bastion against invaders, and that... It says it was a walled, it was walled. And then they have these suburbs. Now, they don't say whether these suburbs are like quarters or whether they're two areas that have a total of 2,000 regular population, and whether they're outside the walls or whether there's a wall built around them like the new city in Greyhawk or such. I would imagine that they'd have to be walled. And then we have the regular inhabitants. They are the bandit merchant caravans and also mercenary companies. So if we look back at the last chapter and the idea of the company of free takers, they could actually be bandits and mercenaries, which was a very common thing, that when the mercenary part didn't have work, or whenever they felt like it, they would turn even on their employers and rob and steal. And that was a very common thing with, untrustworthy mercenaries. And you would expect the ones coming from the bandit kingdom would be untrustworthy. We have the structure is a lord mayor, but that may just be a name. He is boss. And then we have this business of just how much territory they're controlling, when they, that he's controlling around Stoink, 50 to 70,000. So Stoink, I am wrong. Stoink would probably not be an area that the city-state of Stoink would probably not be an area that was overwhelmed with monsters or humanoids. Unless that number... It doesn't mention that part of the population is humanoid, but with a bandit kingdom, that is a possibility. But that even whoever inhabits that area, 50,000 to 70,000 people are in that area. And although they need, you know, farmers and such, that is pretty impressive. That's a pretty large population. It doesn't mean, I believe, according to this, one of the flaws in some of the early Greyhawk setting material, was that sometimes when they said about a population, it only meant the human fighting force. That you might have a population of 12,000, but that would only include the city's fighters. And then you'd go and you'd look at another bit, and it would say, but there are, you know, an additional like 5,000 or 6,000 humanoids, and there you didn't know if, like, they might have 5,000 dwarves, but you wouldn't know if those 5,000 were fighters, the whole population, women, children, elderly. And in this, with the context, I'm assuming that the 50,000 to 70,000, and the 12,000 to 14,000, that's not just fighting men. I'd assume that's total population.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It is something that I think the fans, you know, it's fan work that I think settling what the, you know, a consistent measure of population. And to work out, I think, what, you know, what the whole population is, and from there to work out what the fighting population is. And I also think that if you're going to talk about populations, you really shouldn't break it up into human, demi-human, humanoid. It should be one number and then broken down into these various, you know, like there's 5,000 dwarves and, you know, 5,000 humans and 1,000 gnomes and 1,000 half, you know, something like that, where instead of breaking it down into these, you know, rather vague numbers. I like the bare bones aspect of the Greyhawk setting, but adding a few details like that is just fleshing out the skeleton.
I couldn't find either of the suburbs on the map, but I don't think that's his big a deal as Galesford was.
No, but it is interesting that Stoink was going to be one of the write-ups that Gygax had talked about. So, you know, it was going to be, I mean, there were so few things that were actually detailed. Now, Gygax had promised a detailed Castle Greyhawk, City of Greyhawk, Plain of Shadows, which never really understood. I didn't really see why that would be, you know, a big Greyhawk thing, but obviously had an idea about it, and it would have been wonderful to see what the connection was. And then Stoink. And I think that would be, you know, that would be another nice project to try to figure out. Now, Stoink sounds like it's awfully, awfully big. And it may be one of the bigger Bandit Kingdoms areas. It is one of the ones toward the edge of the Bandit Kingdoms, and so it might be a little healthier place to live than, you know, some of the others might be more wild. But with that size population, it doesn't sound like it's a real monster-infested area. It might have humanoids. It might have demi-humans. But it doesn't sound like it's incredibly dangerous, because that's a big population for that area.
I think it's probably, Stoink is probably the biggest city around there. I'm looking, but it's probably where a lot of the bandits come to trade.
And merchants outside, because the bandits, they're going to be able to sell stuff to their own population, and it's a big population. But they're also going to bring in people, merchants will come in to buy the goods that are taken to Stoink, you know, as well as the bandit merchants coming and regular merchants coming. That'll also be a city that would got the trade of legitimate non-bandit merchants coming there to take advantage of these stolen goods. But you could imagine that any of those things would have to be like merchant trains would have to have, you know, a strong amount of guards and protection. you know, going to this, going to these cities, going to this area where there are these merchant bandits and people like the company of free takers, where they're just going to get robbed, you know, if right. they're weak. So I would assume there would probably be regular, large, strong caravans. And we might also, there might also be seasonal fairs, like, you know, we had with Carpano and Radagast City. Radagast City had its fair in the, you know, the springtime, and Carpano had its, you know, fair during the reaping. So, you know, it does, you know, like part of all this is thinking about it and trying to be inspired by the, you know, the information that we're given right here. And so I really find, you know, I'm very intrigued. I would love to know if there were any notes that Gygax had written about Stoink. He'd obviously thought about it and expanding it, and as he mentioned that. But you know, sometimes that could only be a couple, you know, a couple of notes down, but... you know, anything would be wonderful. If we see the kind of living detail we get from the novels, it would be really good to see the kind of notations for some one of the very few planned Greyhawk projects out there that never came to fruition, you know.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That would have been great.
No, I know. And this is also one of the things that offended that reviewer on Gizmodi so much.
What, Stoink?
Stoink, yeah, that he just... You know, he thought it was a stupid name, and I mean, it's—I don't know why.
It's the setting. I mean, I don't see what the problem is.
Well, you know, it's to me, it's a fine name. It doesn't mean anything. I don't think, or it, you know, who knows? It might in some other language because Gygax liked picking out things. But it's one of the names. It's you know, it's a solid sounding name. You know. And you know, with strong consonants in it, and it's you know, it's one syllable. It's very memorable, and I think that's a fine name. But yeah, it's not just because if Gygax is thinking of detailing that, then there had to be ideas in his head about having a huge. Amount of adventures around the area. Oh shit!
It's still going.
I know. I've unfortunately logged out right there, and I have to. Wait a minute. Did I? What happened to it?
I can.
No,
still...
I'm sorry. It didn't log out. It just my cursor moved over a little bit.
Oh.
All right. I'm gonna. It's past 7 o'clock. You know, we have reached here a good ending point. I think Gord has gone through another bit of adventure, and I think this is a good point. It's the ending point. We're ending here on page 141, I want to make sure from now on to mention what page we're ending on, because I want to detail in the archives what each recording is covering. So I'm gonna end the recording right here. To everybody listening to the archive, you know, I hope you enjoy it. And feel free to either contact me and comment, or hopefully we'll have a text forum up, and you can add any comments or questions right there. Right. Good night.